When doubt is the heart's neighbour, then must the soul turn sour. Both praise and blame are warranted when the spirit of a man, though undefeated, contradicts itself, as the magpie's colour does. And yet he may become a happy man, for in him are both parts, of heaven and of hell. The faithless companion is entirely black and treads only the dark path, while the one with faithful thoughts remains in the light. This flying example is much too swift for simple people. Their thinking cannot comprehend it. Before their grasp it flees like a startled hare. Tin behind heavy glass reflects, like the blind man's dream, only the shape of the face. It does not endure with any strength, because the light shines too weakly. It gives merely fleeting joy. He who grasps me where no hair grows, on the inside of my hand, that one knows a close grip indeed. If as a result I cry out, that just shows my perspicuity. Should I look for loyalty exactly where it vanishes, as fire in the fountain or dew in the sun? But I never knew a man so wise that he would not be an eager listener and agree that my story is important and provides worthy lessons. The story never falters. By turns it runs away and pursues. It dodges and attacks. It blames and praises. Whoever can make sense of all these strands, by that man has wit done well. He neither idly sits nor wanders off. He understands himself well. The mind of a false friend is destined for hellfire. To high nobility it is a hailstorm. Its loyalty has a tail too short to prevent each third bite when swatting flies in the forest. The observations I have made here are certainly not limited to men. Women, too, I hold to the same standard. Any woman who follows my advice shall know where to grant her praise and honour, and upon whom to bestow her love and respect, so that she will not regret the gift of her devotion and purity. Before God I pray for virtuous women, that they might follow the righteous path. Humility is the highest of all virtues. I may offer no more reverent prayer. The false maiden garners false praise. How permanent is the thin ice that lies in the August sun? Her good name will just as quickly vanish. Many a beautiful woman comes in for praise, yet if the heart be false, I praise her no more than I would a worthless bauble set in gold. I count it as no small thing if someone chooses lowly brass for the setting of a noble ruby and all its adventure and mystery. In the same way I account a woman's spirit. If she does right by her wisdom, then I judge not her outward appearance, the mere visible covering of her heart. If that heart beats faithfully in her breast, then genuine praise is not amiss. If I were of woman and man to render the best judgment that I could, the telling would make a long tale. Now listen to the substance of this story. It will bring you knowledge both of love and of sorrow. Joy and distress are in it together. Now imagine that instead of one of me there were three, each one having the same artistic skill as myself. It would still be an unheard-of achievement if they could easily tell what I alone intend to relate. They would undertake a lot of work. I will tell you a story that bears witness to great faithfulness, speaks of womanly women, and tells likewise of a man's manhood, against which no hardship could prevail. His heart never betrayed him. He stood firm when he faced adversity. His victorious hand claimed many times a praiseworthy prize. A courageous man, wise by successive steps, thus I hail the hero. One dear to women's eyes, and thereby a sorrow to women's hearts. One who shuns all wrongdoing. The one to whom I refer is, as far as the story goes, not yet born. The one whom this adventure concerns, and of whom many wonders will be told therein. There is an ancient rule, sometimes observed, where here and there the law remains that way. Our little realm is such a place. You know that without hearing it from me. There the lord of the land upholds the law without a trace of shame. That is the truth, no doubt. That the oldest brother should inherit his father's whole estate. This was the younger brother's disadvantage, for in their father's death they lost the rights that while he was alive they had enjoyed. Whereas before all wealth was held in common, now suddenly the eldest owned it all. Such was the judgment of a learned man, that age be given this advantage. Youth has many blessings, for which age sighs and sorrows. Never was anything so miserable as old age and poverty. Kings, counts, dukes, I tell you no lie. That they should lose their holdings to an eldest child, that is a strange custom. The gallant and the brave Gamurret the warrior lost his castles and land, for his dear father bore sceptre and crown with great royal power until he lay dead in knightly combat. Then there was wailing and grief. He commanded the highest loyalty and honour unto his very death. His eldest son summoned to himself the princes of his realm. They came in knightly fashion, for they by right expected to receive from him great unrestricted grants of land. When they came to the court and their claims were heard, and they all received their grants, now hear what they said indeed. They made as their loyalty commanded, rich and poor, the entire host of them, a doubtful yet sincere request that the king display his brotherly loyalty to Gamurit, and to honour to himself that he stinted nothing, and assign him of his lands an estate that one might see from where the lord derived his name and freeman's status. That was not disagreeable to the king. He said, "You make a worthy request. I will grant this and more besides. Why not name my brother Gamurit Angevin? Anjou is my country. Let both of us bear its name." The king also said this, "My brother is right to expect much help from me, more than I can quickly discharge. Let him become a member of my court. In this way I shall show to everyone a single mother bore the both of us. He has but little, and I have enough. So let my hand bestow a part of it, that my salvation be not forfeited before the one who gives and takes away, as each of those befits." When the mighty princes all understood that their lord was acting in good faith, it was a dear day for them. Each one bowed before him. Gamurit broke his silence. He followed the prompting of his heart. To the king he graciously said, "My lord and brother, were I to join your household, or that of any man, I would have everything at my convenience. Now take the measure of my worth. You are honourable and wise, and advise me as to what is proper, then help me do it. I have nothing but my armour. Had I accomplished more in it, it would bring me greater renown, so that others might remember me." Gamurit continued, "I have 16 squires, 6 of them armoured. Give me in addition 4 pages of good manners from fine families. From them I will withhold nothing that ever my hand might obtain. I aim to journey far throughout the land. I have already done some travelling. If I am lucky, I shall enjoy the fellowship of a good woman. If I treat her honourably, and if I am worthy of it, then my best thought will lead me to behave with true loyalty. May God reveal the blessed path to me. We have risen together when our father Gandan still held your kingdom, and both of us have suffered, for love, many bitter pains. You are a knight and a thief. You could both serve and deceive a lady. Would that I too could steal love. If only I had your skill, and through it could enjoy such favor." The king sighed and said, "Alas, that I ever knew you, as you with shameful behavior have entirely broken my heart by suggesting that we part. My father has left plenty of wealth to both of us. I grant to you an equal part of it. I hold you dear to my heart. Bright jewels, red gold, men, weapons, horses, garments, of these take so much from my hand that you might do as you wish and maintain your generosity. Your manhood is exceptional. If you had been born in Gilstrum or come here from Ranculat, still I would keep you here always, for I am very fond of you. You are my brother, no matter what. Lord, you praise me of necessity, because your noble temperament demands it. Show me your assistance after the same fashion. If you and my mother share your wealth with me, then I'll go always up and never down. Yet still my heart is yearning for the heights. I know not why it is so full of life that so swells the left side of my breast. Oh, where will my desire drive me? I shall discover that if I can. Now the day of my departure is here." The king granted him everything, even more than he had asked for. 5 horses true and tested, the best in his whole land, brave, strong, and not slow, many a precious vessel, and many a bar of gold. Nor did the king refuse at all to fill 4 travelling chests for him, pouring in jewels until they were full. As they were being filled, the pages who were in charge were beautifully dressed and mounted. Then there was no lack of grieving when he went to see his mother, and she clasped him tightly to herself. "Son of King Gandan, will you no longer stay with me?" said that womanly woman. "Alas, my body bore you. You are also Gandan's child. Is God in his help blind, or is he deaf that he does not heed me? Shall I now know fresh grief? I have buried the strength of my heart, the beauty of my eyes. If he robs me further, and is yet a judge, then the gospel lies to me when it speaks of his help, since he has completely abandoned me." Then said the young Angevin, "God comfort you, lady, for the loss of my father. Let us both mourn him in all earnestness, but about me let no one say any words of mourning. For the sake of my honour, I go in quest of knightly deeds in strange lands. Lady, this is what I must do." Then the queen said, As you towards courtly love are directing your spirit and service, dear son, do not refuse to take my wealth upon your journey. Tell your attendants to receive from me 4 heavy chests, inside are wide loads of silk, whole cloth, never cut, and precious samite as well. Dear man, let me know the day when you shall return. You are the source of all my joy. Lady, I have no idea in what country one might find me. Yet wherever I go, you have, as befits a knight, bestowed upon me your nobility. Moreover, the king has released me in a manner that deserves my highest thanks. I assure you that because of it, you will hold him in high regard, no matter what becomes of me. As the adventure tells us, this dauntless hero had received, through the power of love and through a woman's fellowship, gifts worth 1,000 marks. Even today, a Jew would receive them as security and value them at that amount. He would not disdain to do so at all. These were sent to him by his beloved. Through his service, he had won the love and greetings of a woman, but seldom had he experienced grief. The warrior took his leave. Mother, brother, even his home country, his eyes never saw again. Because of it, many experienced great loss. To anyone who had ever bestowed a favor upon him, with great fervor he expressed his thanks. He deemed their generosity more than sufficient. Because of his courtesy, he never imagined that they did only what was required. In this way was his nature unassuming. Anyone who proclaims his own value will not be believed. It should be others, and ones that observe his actions in unfamiliar places. Then one can believe the tale. Gamoret did those things that moderation required and no others. He rarely boasted. He meekly bore great honor. He disavowed all haughtiness. Yet this noble man felt there was no one who wore a crown, king, emperor, empress, whose court he wished to join, unless that one had supreme power over all the lands of the earth. Such desire lay in his heart. He learned that in Baghdad there was a man so powerful that he ruled much of the earth, 2/3 or more. His name among the heathens was so great that they called him the Baruch. Such was his power that many kings were his vassals and their crowns were subject to him. The office of the Baruch exists today, just as Christian law looks to Rome as our faith decrees. There one sees the heathen order ruled. From Baghdad they take their commands, as their religion deems entirely proper. The Baruch gives them absolution for their sins. From 2 brothers from Babylon, Pompey and Epaminondas, the Baruch had taken Nineveh, which had belonged to all their ancestors. They had defended it vigorously. Then came the young Angevin. The Baruch held him in great favor. He took him into his service. Gamoret, the worthy man, took a coat of arms of a different design than Gangan his father had given him. As one with high aspirations, he chose for his symbol an anchor of white ermine, sewn on his horse's caparison and elsewhere, on his shield and garments. Greener than emerald was his saddle gear, and made from akmadi, that is a silken material. From it was fashioned his surcoat and gambeson. It is superior to samite. His anchor had not yet gone on a voyage, nor had it been cast anywhere. His anchor, which did not signify any state or province, he wore throughout his travels. The lord who displayed this symbol of home was a stranger in every land that he visited. Though emblazoned with an anchor, nevertheless he found no place where he could dwell or take his rest. Throughout how many kingdoms did he ride? Around how many did he sail in ships? If I were called upon to swear to that, I would say, upon my good word as a knight, what the adventure tells me, I have no other authority. It says that his manly strength won praise throughout the heathen lands, from Morocco to Persia. Elsewhere his hand prevailed as well, in Damascus and in Aleppo, and wherever knightly deeds were accomplished, in Araby and throughout all the Arab lands, until he was no longer challenged by any man whatever. Such was the reputation he acquired. His heart's desire was the quest for fame. Before him all the deeds of others vanished and became almost as nothing. So learned every man who engaged with him in jousting. In Baghdad the people said that his courage never failed. From there he travelled into Zazamank. In that kingdom all the people were mourning Eisenhart, who had lost his life in service of a lady. He lost it to Belcane, the dear and blameless. Because she did not give him her love, he died from his love for her. His kinsmen now exacted their revenge both openly and in secret by besieging the lady. She was vigorously defending herself when Gamoret came to her land, which Fridibrand the Scot had assailed with ships and then left. Now hear what happened to our knight. The sea tossed him about with such a storm that he barely escaped it. Towards the queen's palace, he sailed into the harbour and was seen by many, everyone in the lands thereabout. There many tents were pitched on every side except against the sea. Two powerful armies were encamped there. He told his men to inquire whose castle this was, because he did not know, nor did his captain. His messengers returned with the news that it was Patalamont. The answer was graciously given. The people beseeched them by their gods to render aid as they were in distress. They fought with naught but death itself. When the young Angevin learned of their dire need, he offered them his services for hire, as many knights still do, and asked what would be the reward for incurring the enemy's wrath. They responded with one voice, the sick and the well, that everything they had would be his, their gold and their jewels. He would be lord of it all, and he would live in fine style among them. But he required little wealth. Of the gold of Araby he had brought back many an ingot. People black as night were all the inhabitants of Zazamunk. Among them he felt ill at ease. Yet he took his lodging. The people were very pleased to give him the best that they could. The ladies were still leaning out of the windows to see him. They had a good look at his men and at his armour and how it was adorned. The noble hero displayed upon his ermine shield I don't know how many sable pelts. The queen's marshal saw that they resembled a large anchor. The sight was not displeasing to him. It seemed to his eyes that he had seen before either this knight or his likeness. That must have been at Alexandria, when the Baruch was besieging that city. At that time no one equaled his achievement. Thus rode the one rich in spirit, in good cheer, into the city. He ordered 10 pack horses loaded. They bore his belongings. 20 squires rode behind. His household staff appeared in front. Pages, cooks, and their boys were at the head of the procession. His retinue was proud. 12 high-born youths rode behind the squires, of good breeding, with courtly manners. Several of them were Saracens. After them came 8 horses with their flanks garbed in silk. The 9th bore his saddle. A shield, which I mentioned before, a squire very cheerfully carried. Alongside, next to the trumpeter, who was of course required, a drummer beat his drum and raised it high in the air. The lord would have been very upset if flute players had not ridden with them, and 3 good fiddlers. None of them was in a hurry. He himself rode last, and his ship's captain, a man both famous and wise. All the people in the city were Moors and Mooresses, every woman and man of them. The lord saw many shattered shields riven with spears. Many hung there on wall and door. They were sorrowful all around. In the window against the breeze lay abed many a wounded man, such that even if he saw a doctor, he would never become well. This was the result of the battle. So it goes with men who refuse to flee. Many horses were led past, pierced and run through. Many dark-skinned ladies he saw on both sides. Their appearance was like the raven's colour. He was received with grace. Later, this reception brought him joy. He was a man rich in courage. With his hand he had dealt many a thrust and blow when he guarded a gate. Near him he found many a knight whose arms hung in slings and whose heads were in bandages. Though they were wounded, they still performed knightly deeds. Their power was not diminished in this way. The governor of the city graciously bade his guest not to refrain from claiming whatever he wished of his person and possessions. He led him to his wife, who kissed Gamorit, little as he relished it. Then they went to breakfast. When that was finished, the marshal left him to go to the queen to ask her for a very large reward. He said, "Lady, our distress is ended now in joy. This man whom we have welcomed is a knight of such a nature that we shall ever more profusely thank our gods who brought him to us, that they bethought themselves to do so. Now tell me, on your loyalty, who this knight might be." "Lady, he is a mighty warrior, a soldier of the Baruch, an Angevin of noble lineage. Oh, how little does he hold back his person in the thick of battle. How skillfully, this way and that, he dodges and feints. He deals out sorrow to the enemy. I saw him in glorious strife when the Babylonians were supposed to be rescuing Alexandria, and they were attempting to drive the Baruch away by force. What a lot of them were destroyed in the defeat. Then that wonderful man accomplished such feats of arms that they had no choice but to run away. Besides, I heard it said of him that men should well acknowledge that he has won with his own hand great honour throughout many a land. Now determine when and how he will speak with me, and arrange for it to occur. All day today we have a truce, so the hero can easily ride here to see me, or should I go there? His colour is not like ours. Oh, how I hope that doesn't bother him. I should like to find out whether my people advise me to treat him with honour. If he comes to me, how should I receive him? Is he high enough born for me that my kiss will not be wasted on him? Lady, it is well known that he is the kin of kings. I pledge my life on it. Lady, I will tell your princes to put on their best clothes and wait with you for the two of us to ride here. You may tell this to your serving women. When I ride there now, I will bring you this worthy guest who lacks nothing for dear virtue. Very little of this was overlooked. With great diligence, the marshal worked to carry out his lady's bidding. In short order, Gamorrot was given splendid clothes to wear. He put them on. I have heard it said that they were quite elegant. Anchors heavy with Arabian gold were sewn thereon at his request. Then that rich reward of love mounted upon a horse which a Babylonian had ridden in jousting against him. He had unhorsed that man and caused him grief. And did his host ride with him? He did, together with his knights. Indeed, they were happy to do so. Thus they rode together and stopped before the palace, where many knights were stationed. Of course, they all were finely dressed. His pages entered before him in twos, hand in hand. Their master beheld several ladies within, wonderfully attired. The noble queen's eyes caused her great pain when she beheld the Angevin. He was so lovely in appearance that he unlocked her entire heart, whether for good or ill for her. Her womanhood till then had kept it shut. Then she stepped towards him a little and invited her guest to kiss her. She took him by the hand, along a wall that faced the enemy. They sat in a window seat on a cushion of samite under which lay a soft mattress. If there is something brighter than the day, in no way did the queen resemble it. She had a womanly bearing and was, though like a knight in other ways, quite unlike a dewy rose. Her appearance was black in colour, her crown a translucent ruby, through which one clearly saw her head. The host said to her guest that she treasured his arrival. Lord, I have heard of you and your many knightly achievements. Be not distressed in your nobility if I bewail my sorrow, which I carry next to my heart. Lady, my help will not fail you. Whatever troubles you, let my hand be pledged unto your service. Though I am but a single man, and though it may be a small contribution, I offer my shield against all those who seek to do you harm. One prince spoke courteously thus, If we but had a leader, little would we spare the enemy now that Fridibrand is gone. He is off defending his own country. A king, Hernant by name, whom he slew for her Lindy's sake, has kinsmen who now cause him grief enough. They show no signs that they will soon relent. He has left heroes behind here. The Duke Hutiger, whose knightly deeds have caused us distress, and his company, their fighting prowess has skill and power. Another with many a soldier here is Gashir of Normandy, the warrior great and wise. Even more knights has Caled of Hoskolast. They are many angry guests. All of these came into this country with Fridibrand the Scottish king and his four companions with many soldiers. To the west along the sea there lies Eisenhart's force with streaming eyes. In public or in private no man has beheld them, but he has marvelled at their wondrous grief. The reining of their hearts produces floods. Since in the joust their lord has lost his life. The guest unto his hostess with knightly bearing said, Tell me, if you will do so, the reason why you suffer such attacks of violence and wrath. Your knights are many and are valiant. It makes me sad to see them thus encumbered by enemy hatred to their disadvantage. That, sir, I shall tell you, since you ask. A worthy knight once served me. His body was a blooming bough of virtue. The hero was bold and wise, a loyal and a firmly rooted fruit. His courtesy outweighed all others. He was more modest than a woman. His person embodied daring and bravery. Never grew up a knight more generous than him throughout the land. I know not what may occur after us. Let others speak of that. To every false behaviour he was deaf, in colour black like me, a Moor. His father was called Tancanis, a king. He also was of great renown. The name of my beloved was Eisenhart. My womanhood was ill-advised in accepting his love's service, as it did not end in joy for him. For that I must always bear sorrow. His men imagined that I murdered him. In fact, I am hardly capable of guile, despite their accusations. He was dearer to me than he was to them. I lack not witnesses for what I claim. The honest truth is known to both my gods and theirs. He caused me much grief, but my modest womanhood prolonged his waiting and my suffering. My maidenly shyness spurred the hero to ever greater deeds of knightly fame. I tested him to see if he could be my beloved. That soon became apparent. On my account he gave his gear away, that like a palace stands there. It is a lofty tent brought by the Scotsmen to this field. Once the hero lost his possessions, his health was hardly spared. He lost interest in life, seeking out adventures without arms. When matters stood this way, a prince, Prothesilas by name, one of my courtiers, free from all cowardice, rode out toward adventure, where great grief did not miss him. In the forest of Azaguk, a joust to the death was no joke. He charged against a brave man who also met his end. That was my beloved Eisenhart. Each warrior suffered a spear through shield and body. For this I grieve today, a woeful woman. Both deaths distress me still. Grief blooms in the ground of my loyalty. Never have I been wed to any man. Gamorrit clearly saw that though she was a heathen, no woman's heart was better endowed with feminine loyalty. Her innocence was a pure baptism, as was the rain that soaked her, the flood that flowed from her eyes, into her clothes and onto her bosom. Her purpose was the business of sorrow and the experience of true grief. She continued, "Then the king of the Scots with his host sought me from across the sea. He was his uncle's son. They could bring me no more pain than was inflicted by Eisenhart himself, I must confess it." The lady gave out sighs and through her tears many glances in the manner of a bashful guest at Gamorrit, for clearly her eyes told her heart that it was handsomely constructed. She could also appreciate light complexions, for she had laid eyes upon many fair-skinned heathens. Thus arose between them a genuine desire. She saw him and he saw her. She ordered that the parting toast be given. She would have preferred to skip it. It vexed her that she could not, for it always drove away the knights who enjoyed speaking with women. Yet her person was now his. He had caused her to believe that his life was the lady's life as well. Then he stood up and said, "Lady, I do you a disservice. I can sit here no longer. That would be thoughtless of me. It causes me great grief that your sorrow is so deep. Lady, command me. Wherever you wish, there shall my power be. I shall serve you however I may." She responded, "Sir, I believe you will." The governor, his host, now left little undone to make the time pass quickly for him. He asked whether he would like to ride out to the battlefield and see how our gates are defended. Gamorrit, the worthy warrior, said that he would gladly see where such feats of knighthood had occurred. Down with the hero rode several noble knights, some seasoned, others new. They led him around to 16 gates and explained to him that none of them had been shut since Eisenhart began to be avenged upon us with wrath. Night and day our strife has been unending. No gate have we closed since. Before 8 gates we are assailed by men loyal to Eisenhart. They have caused us great grief. They fight fearsomely, these princes nobly born, these vassals of the king of Azaguk. Before each gate there flies above a brave host a bright flag, on which is depicted an impaled knight. As Eisenhart has lost his life, such is the coat of arms his men have chosen. Opposing that device, we have our own, and with it we pay tribute to their grief. Our banner may be recognized by 2 fingers of the hand outstretched to swear an oath that never did such woe occur to her as when Eisenhart lay dead. That caused my lady her heart's sorrow. There stands the noble queen, the Lady Belcaine, in sharp relief on white samite emblazoned in black. Ever since we saw their banners, their loyalty causes them grief. These have flown high over our gates. Before the other 8 gates, we are assailed by proud Fridabrand's host, baptized Christian men from across the sea. A prince commands each gate. He leads his forces out with his banner. We have captured one of Gashir's counts. He offers us a large ransom. He is Caled's sister's son. Whatever Caled does to us, he must pay for. We seldom have such luck. There is hardly any turf, just 30 horse lengths of sandy ground, from the moat to their tents. There we fight many a joust, his host continued his report. A single knight never fails to come out and join the joust. If he were to serve in vain for the one who sent him out, what would be the purpose of his challenge? That is the proud Hildegar. About him I would like to tell you more. Ever since we have been under siege, that dauntless hero has appeared each morning before the gate opposite the palace. To that brave man many a lady has given her favour, which he has run through our shields. They are deemed to be of great value when our warriors' arms receive them. He has cost us many a brave knight. He is eager to be seen, and our women praise him too. When women praise a man, he garners fame. He has the prize in his hand, and his heart's desire. Now the weary sun had gathered up its rays. The end of the day was at hand. The guest rode back with his host, and there he found his supper all prepared. I must tell you about their meal. It was set out properly, as befits a knight. The splendid queen sat proudly at his table. Here was heron, there was fish. She remained with him the entire time. She wanted to ensure that he was well attended. She was there with her serving girls. She knelt down, this caused him grief, and with her own hand she cut for the knight his portion of food. The lady was delighted with her guest. She served him his drink and tended him well. For his part he observed her behaviour and her words. At the foot of the table sat his minstrels, and on the other side his chaplain. Shyly he looked at the lady. Blushing, he said, "Never in my life have I been served with such honour, lady, as you show me here. If I am permitted to say it, I would have chosen the treatment I deserve, and you would not have ridden here. If I may ask it of you now, lady, let me live in moderation. You have shown me too much honour." She did not relent. Going to where his pages sat, she bade them to eat heartily. She did this to honour her guest. Every one of these young gentlemen was enamoured of the queen, nor did the lady neglect to go over to where the governor sat with his wife. The queen raised her cup and said, "To you I commend our guest. The honour is yours. I urge this upon you both." She bade farewell, and yet again she went over to her guest. His heart felt love for her. The same was true of her for him. Her heart and her eyes declared it, for they took on the burden with her. Courteously the lady said, "Command, sir, whatever you wish I shall perform, for you are worthy of it. Now permit me to take my leave. If you have a good rest, we shall be extremely pleased." Her torch holders were gold. 4 torches went before her. She rode back to where there were torches enough. They ended their meal. The hero was both sad and happy. It pleased him to be shown great honour, yet he felt distress. That was the strength of love, which humbles mighty spirits. The hostess quickly took her leave. Swift was her departure. They prepared a bed for the hero. They did it with care. The host said to the guest, "Now you should sleep soundly and rest well. You will need it." The host told his men that they should leave. The guest's pages had their beds facing his in a circle, as was his custom. There stood candles of great size, burning brightly. It bothered the hero that the night was so long. He felt weakened by the words of the black Morris, the queen of the land. He tossed and turned like a willow branch, so that his joints cracked. Strife and love were his desire. Now let us hope that he achieves both. His heart beat loudly as he yearned for knightly conquests. It began to strain his breast, as the bow does the bowstring. Such was his desire. The hero lay bereft of all sleep, until he saw the day dawning. Not yet did it brightly shine. Then his chaplain prepared himself for mass. He sang it for God and for the knight. They brought him his armour. He rode out to the jousting place. Straight away he mounted upon a horse that could both charge headlong and swiftly leap, responding instantly to his command. They saw his anchor upon his tall helmet, riding before the gate. Man and woman alike proclaimed that they had never seen such a handsome knight. Their gods should be like him. They brought him stout spears. How was he equipped? His horse wore a covering of iron. That was for protection against blows. Over it was another covering, not heavy, and made of green samite. His surcoat and his gambeson were also of green ahmadi, made in Araby. I tell you no lie, his shield straps and their fastenings were unbleached thongs studded with precious stones. Refined in flame was the red gold of his shield. His service was in the name of love. A fierce fight was nothing to him. The queen sat in the window. With her sat her ladies. Now look, here comes Hildegard, in the very spot where he has won the prize. When he sees this knight approaching, galloping towards him, he thinks, "When and how comes this French knight into this land? Who has sent that proud man here? If I took him for a Moor, my best thinking would be foolish." They did not delay the attack. Both spurred their horses from a gallop to full speed. They put on a knightly show and did not fail to joust each other. The splinters flew into the air from the shaft of Hildegard's spear. The impact threw him over his horse and onto the grass. He was not accustomed to this at all. Gamurrit rode over to trample him down. He picked himself up briskly and ready to defend himself. Yet Gamurrit's lance had pierced him in the arm. He asked to surrender. He had met his master. "Who has bested me?" so said the brave man. The victor replied, "I am Gamurrit the Angevin." The other said, "I give you my promise of surrender." He accepted and sent him into the city. This was much praised by the women who saw it. Now came Gashir of Normandy, rich in valour and a strong jouster. Gamurrit, undaunted, prepared himself for the second joust. Broad was his iron spearhead and firm the shaft. Then the two strangers assailed each other with unequal strength. Gashir was thrown, horse and all, to a fall in the joust, and was compelled to surrender, whether for good or for ill for him. Gamorrat the warrior said, "Your hand pledges surrender. Its defence was manly. Now ride over to the Scottish army and bid that they spare us their assault, if it so pleases them, and come with me into the city." Everything he ordered or requested was carried out exactly. The Scots had to stop fighting. Next came Caelid. Gamorrat turned away from him, for he was his mother's sister's son. How could he do him harm? The Spaniard called after him enough. He wore an ostrich on his helmet. The man was dressed, as I must tell you, in felled silk, wide and long. The field rang as the hero passed. He wore bells on his armour. He was a flower of manly beauty. His beauty was unsurpassed except by two who came after him, Beacors, the son of Lot, and Parsifal, who were not here. They were still unborn and destined for great beauty. Gashir took him by the bridle. "Your wildness will become very tame, so I tell you on my honour, if you attack the Angevin, who has my guarantee of surrender, heed my advice, sir, and my request. I have promised Gamorrat that I would cease all strife. I set it in his hands. For my sake, leave off your attack. He will show you strength in battle." Then said Caelid the king, "If it is my cousin Gamorrat, son of King Gandun, I will not attack him. Let go of my bridle. I will not let go of it until I first see with my own eye your uncovered head. Mine is dazed." He took off his helmet. Gamorrat found more fighting. It was now well into mid-morning, which pleased the people of the city as they observed the jousting. They all began to go out, in truth every one of them. Before them he was as a net. Whatever came under it was ensnared. As I heard it told, the worthy man mounted another horse. It flew and hugged the ground with equal ease, keen when commanded to charge, check, or wheel. What did he do on this horse? That must I account as bravery. He rode out to where the Moors could see him, where their army lay, westward along the sea. There was a prince there called Rasalik, who was in that day the greatest man in Azagouk. His lineage assured that, as he was descended from kings, who never failed each day to come to the city for jousting. Then the hero from Anjoy put a stop to his power. A black woman bewailed, she who had sent him out, that he had been overthrown. A page, without being asked, brought his hero Gamorrat a spear, the shaft of which was of bamboo. With it he drove the Moor back over his horse onto the gravel. He did not let him lie there very long. His hand forced him to guarantee surrender. Thus was the conflict ended, and a great prize awarded to him. Gamorrat saw 8 banners streaking toward the city, which he ordered sent back by the brave but unsuccessful man. He further ordered him to follow him inside. This he did, as there was nothing else to do. Gashir, not failing to arrive inside the walls, advised the host that his guest was in the field. If that host did not eat iron like an ostrich, and gnaw at mighty rocks, that was because none were at hand. His wrath began to growl and roar like a lion. He tore at his own hair. He said, "Now in my mature years I am behaving with the worst folly of youth. The gods have sent me a brave and worthy guest. If he is burdened with more fighting than he can handle, of what use are my shield and sword? He mocks me, who reminds me of such a failure." Then he turned away from the people and galloped off towards the gate. A squire brought him a shield, decorated outside and in, with an impaled knight made in Eisenhart's land. He also bore a helmet in his hand, and a sword that Rasalik had wielded bravely in the fight. That was taken from him, the brave and black-complexioned heathen. His fame travelled far and wide. If he died without baptism, then let him have mercy on that brave warrior, who has all miracles in his power. When the governor saw the shield, he had never been so delighted. Recognizing the coat of arms, he went out of the gate at a gallop. He saw his guest, the young one, not the old one, eagerly awaiting the joust. There the host, whose name was Lacfilirost, led him back into the city. He never fought another combat there. Lacfilirost, the governor, said, "Sir, if you would tell me, have you struck down with your hand Rasalik? If so, our land is safe from war forever." He commanded all the Moors, those vassals of Eisenhart, who have done us harm. Our suffering has ended. An angry god commanded them to strike us with their host. Now their champion is humbled. He brought Gamorrat in, loath as he was to follow. The queen rode down to meet him. She took his bridle with her hand and untied the fastenings of his ventail. The governor surrendered the bridle. His pages did not fail to run to attend their lord. Through the city they saw the wise queen leading her guest, who had taken the prize. She dismounted at the proper time. "Oh, how devoted your pages are! You seem to think you will lose this man. Without you, he will be well attended." Take his horse and lead it away. In this city I am his friend. He found many ladies there. The black hands of the queen ungirded him. In a coverlet of sable and a bed beautifully adorned, there he was granted an intimate honour. No one was there. The maidens had gone out and shut the door. The queen bestowed a sweet and noble love, and Gamurrit was her heart's beloved. Their two skin colours were not alike. They brought many offerings to their gods, those of the city. Whatever commands brave Razalik received when he left the battlefield, he performed them all faithfully, yet he felt renewed grief for his lord Eisenhart. The governor was told that he had come. Then there was rejoicing. Princes arrived from all over the queen's land of Zazamank. They gave Gamurrit thanks for the victory he had achieved. In the jousting he had overthrown 24 knights and brought back most of their horses. 3 princes were captured. Many of their knights rode into the palace courtyard. Well rested and breakfasted, and splendidly garbed in garments well prepared, was the body of their highest lord. She who was a maid was now a wife. She led him forth by the hand. She said, "My person and my country are now subject to this knight, if our enemies will agree." Then Gamurrit made a courteous request. "Come nearer, my lord Razalik. You shall kiss my wife. You shall do likewise, Lord Geshir." Hyutika the Scot he asked to kiss her on the lips. He was still wounded from the joust. He told them all to sit, and standing said in jest, "Gladly would I also see my cousin, if I may do so with the permission of the one who captured him. As I am his kinsman, I must set him free." Smiling happily, the queen bade them fetch him. There through the crowd came the handsome count. He bore the wounds from knightly combat, and his many brave deeds therein. Geshir the Norman had brought him there. He was courteous. His father was a Frenchman. He was Caled's sister's son. He had come in service of a woman. His name was Kilir Jakak. He surpassed all other men in beauty. When Gamurrit saw him, their faces showed their kinship, for they were very like each other. He bade the great queen kiss him and embrace him. He said, "Now come over to me." The lord kissed him too. They were happy to see each other. But Gamurrit said, "O sweet young man, whatever brought your tender person here? Tell me, did a woman make you do it?" "No, sir, they ask me little. Geshir, my uncle, brought me here. He well knows why. I have 1,000 of his knights and stand by in his service. To Rouen in Normandy, I went in answer to his call to arms. I brought these young heroes here from Champagne. Now will all the skill and artifice of harm turn against him, unless you act in service of your honour. If you permit it, let him benefit from my kinship and lighten his distress. That decision I will leave to you. Now accompany my lord Geshir and bring me Caled here." Then they gladly followed his request and brought him in as he had asked. Then was he too by Gamurrit graciously received and warmly embraced by the great queen. Nobly she kissed the warrior, and well with honour might she do it. He was her husband's aunt's son, and by birthright was a noble king. Laughing, Gamurrit continued, "God knows, Lord Caled, if I took Toledo and your land of Spain in service of the king of Gascony, who in his wrath is causing you much grief, that would be a disloyal act from me, for you are the son of my aunt, the very best to accompany you here, the core of knighthood. Who gave you this command?" Then the proud young warrior replied, "My uncle Chiltung, whose daughter Fridibrand married, asked me to serve him and thereby serve my uncle. For his wife's sake, he has from my forces 6,000 well-known knights, brave hands all. I brought him still more knights, of whom a part have left. These brave fighters are here on behalf of the Scots. From Greenland came battle-hardened heroes, 2 kings with great strength. A flood of knighthood they brought, and many a ship. That group pleased me well. Here also on his behalf was Morhold. In warfare he has both power and skill. Now these have left. As my lady commands, so shall I do with my forces. My service to her will reveal itself. But do not give me your thanks, for our kinship requires it. Now these dauntless heroes are yours. If they were baptized, as mine are, and of a similar skin colour, there would be no man crowned, but he would have fighting enough from them. But I am amazed to see you here. Tell me about that, and how it happened." "I arrived yesterday. Today I have become the lord of this entire land. The queen conquered me with her own hand. I defended myself with love. So did my good sense counsel me. I understand that sweet defense has defeated both armies." "You mean because I avoided fighting you? You shouted loudly at me. What did you want to take from me by force? Let me bargain with you some other way." "I did not recognize your anchor. My aunt's husband Gandon never wore it." But I recognized your ostrich and the serpent's head on your shield. Your ostrich stood tall without a nest. I saw from your appearance that you ill-liked the oath of surrender that the other two had given me. They had put up a good fight. It could easily have gone the same way with me. I must admit it, even of a devil whose ways I could never abide, if he took such a prize against such mighty heroes as you did, the women would eat him up like sugar. Your mouth bestows excessive praise on me. No, I cannot flatter. Look that I shall give you other help. They called Razalik over to them. Courteously, Caled said, My cousin Gemoret has imprisoned you with his hand. Sir, that he has. I have recognized the hero as one to whom the land of Azaguk will grant homage, now that our lord Eisenhart never again will wear the crown there. He was slain in the service of her who is now your cousin's wife. For her love he gave his life, but my kiss has settled the dispute. I have lost a lord and kinsman. I am ready to perform knightly service for your aunt's son. If he will compensate me for my loss, then I will pledge my hand to him. Thus he will have riches and honor, and everything that Tancanus bequeathed to Eisenhart, who lies there embalmed in the city. I have gazed upon his wounds each day since this spearhead broke his heart. Then he drew it forth from his bosom on a silken ribbon. The warrior quickly put it back against the bare skin of his breast. It is still broad daylight. If my lord Kilajakak will bear the message as I request, my princes will ride along as his escort. He sent a ring as a token. Those who were of Hell's Colour came, the princes there, through the city to the palace. Then Gamorit granted fiefs of land to the princes of Azaguk. Each was delighted with his share, yet the best part remained for Gamorit, their lord. These came first. Next were those from Zazamark. In a grand display, not a weak one, they received, as their lady wished, from Gamorit their land and titles, to each one as befitted him. Poverty fled from those lords. It happened that Protesilas, who was a prince of noble lineage, had left a dukedom. Gamorit bestowed it upon one who gained much honour with his hand. He never avoided battle. Laphileros, the governor, received it that day. The lordly princes of Azaguk took Hutiger the Scot and Gashir the Norman, and led them before their lord. He pronounced them free on their request. For this they thanked Gamorit. Hutiger the Scot they strongly urged as follows. Leave the tent here for our lord as a reward for his adventure. We lost Eisenhart's life when Friedebrand was given his arms and equipment. His joy was lost. He himself lies on his bier. Unrequited service brought him grief. Never was anything so fine on earth as the helmet made of diamond, thick and strong, a good companion in battle. Then vowed Hutiger's hand that when he returned to his lord's land, he would gather up all the equipment and send it back well preserved. This he did unbidden. Now all the princes asked the king for permission to withdraw. Immediately they left the palace. Though his land was devastated, Gamurit's hand could dispense gifts as lavish as if gold grew on trees. He gave out rich presents. His vassals and kinsmen took this hero's wealth from him. That was the queen's desire. Before the wedding feast, there had been many great battles. In this way all was set to right. I did not invent this myself. I was told that Eisenhart was buried as befits a king. Those who knew him did this. The taxes from his lands in the amount of 1 year's worth, they expended of their own free will. Gemurit bade them keep his great wealth for themselves, to enjoy without restriction. The next morning, before the fortress, all the guests took their leave. Those who were there departed, carrying many a stretcher. The field stood bare of shelters, except for one, and it was very large. The king ordered it brought aboard the ship. He told the people that he would bring it to Azaguk. With those words, he deceived them. The proud man remained there until he began to grieve because he found no knightly work to do, and this turned his joy to sorrow. Yet his black wife was dearer to him than his own life. Never was a woman more charming. The lady's heart never failed to display those worthy attributes of true modesty and womanly virtue. In the city of Seville was born the man whom he asked, after a while, to take him away. He had for many a mile already guided him. He had brought him here. He was not coloured like a Moor. The wise mariner said, You should conceal your plan from those whose skins are black. My boats are so swift that they shall never overtake us. We shall get away. He ordered his gold loaded into the ship. And now I must tell you of Sundering. By night the worthy man left. It was done in secret. And when he deserted his wife, she had within her body a child growing for 12 weeks. The wind took him swiftly away. In her purse, the lady discovered a letter written in her husband's hand, in French, which she knew. The writing began to tell her, "Here one love sends his love to another. Through this journey I am a thief. I must be, to spare you grief. Lady, I cannot hide it from you. Were your faith the same as mine, I would be faithful to you forever. As it is, I suffer heartbreak for you forever. Should the child of us two have features like a man, then he will be rich in valor. He is descended from Anjou. Love will be his lady. In battle he will be a hailstorm, to foes a harsh neighbor. My son should know he is descended from one called Gandin, who died in knightly combat. His father suffered the same fate. His name was Adans. Rarely did his shield stay whole. By race he was a Briton. He and Uta Pendragon were the children of two brothers whose names I inscribe here. One was called Lazalais, the other one Bricus. The father of these two was called Mazadan. A fairy took him into Faimogan. Her name was Ter de la Choye. He was her heart's fetter. From these two descends my line, which will shine brightly forevermore. Each one since has worn a crown, and each has had honour enough. Lady, if you are baptized, you may yet win me back." She wished it to be no other way. Alas, how quickly this has come to pass. If he would just return, I would end my faith's allegiance. To whom has his manly nobility left the fruit of his love? Alas, for loving fellowship, now sorrow with her power must rule my life forever. To honour his God, the lady said, I would gladly be baptized and live as he desires. Grief brought strife to her heart. Her joy sought the withered bough, as the turtle dove still does. For she is ever of the same mind. When she has lost a loved one, she perches on a withered tree. In due time, the lady bore a son who was of two colors, in whom God had wrought a marvel. His appearance was both black and white. The queen kissed him all over his white spots. The mother called her little child Ferefiz Angevin. He was to become a forest conqueror. In the jousts his hand would shatter many a spear and pierce many a shield. Like a magpie was the color of his hair and skin. It was now more than a year since Gemwaret was so greatly praised in Zazamank, and his hand had triumphed. He was sailing on the sea. The swift winds were causing him distress. He saw a sail of red silk. The boat that bore it also carried the messengers from Fridibrant the Scot sent to the Lady Belcane. He asked her to forgive him, though he had suffered on her account for attacking her. They had the diamond helmet, a sword, a hauberk, and two leg guards. It must seem a great marvel to you that he encountered them, as the adventure tells me he did. They gave him the equipment. He swore that his mouth would convey the message when he came to her. They departed. I am told that the sea brought them into a harbour. From there he made his way to Seville. With gold, the brave man rewarded his captain well for his hard work. They parted then. It was to his regret.